Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Buntram, culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Alex Reisner, a writer and programmer who has written some stuff for The Atlantic about AI and copyright and large language models that I find incredibly interesting. And I think you will as well, because it really gets to the heart of a lot of what we're talking about when it comes to technology and the internet and the entertainment industry and all that stuff. Alex, thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sonny.
So the reason we have you on today is because in The Atlantic last month's issue and online, they posted a big database, basically a big database that allowed screenwriters to see which of their films, which of the TV shows they've scripted, have been used by large language models to program the AI behind it to be able to interact with people is basically how I think about it. But I also am frankly kind of in the dark about how all this stuff works. How would you describe it to a layman who wants to understand what exactly the large language models are doing with these screenplays?
Yeah, they are basically statistical algorithms. They are trained on millions of documents written by people, and they basically use statistics to figure out how to create new documents like the ones they've been trained on. Artificial intelligence is a little bit of a misnomer. They don't have any intelligence of their own. They're more like machines that imitate the work of other people. And again, they can only do that because of this very clever mathematical modeling of human creative work that they're able to do. And then that allows them to just imitate that work. Does that make sense? I know this is very technical. I'm happy to try to explain it more.
Sure. So I when people think of when people think of AI, I think that the two kind of different ideas you have here, right, are like chatbot programs, where I'm having a conversation with this AI program and we're talking to each other, and then kind of more generative models either in terms of AI program, rewrite this thing for me, or write a new version of this for me, or make an image that looks like this in this model, right? I guess the question then would be, how does the input of an episode of Seinfeld or the Godfather Part One, how does that help the program figure out how to talk to people?
Right. Well, presumably in your Seinfeld episode or The Godfather, there are people asking questions and other people answering them. That's all part of the dialogue of these movies and shows. And so a large language model will sort of glean from that the types of things that constitute questions and the types of things that constitute responses. Again, it's just really manipulating words. And so it just needs to... If you ask a question, it will kind of find a similar group of words that are in its training data and output a group of words that were used also in the training data in response to that, to those words, which we call a question, an answer. Mm-hmm. To it's just word patterns.
And all right. So where do the dialogue actually come from? Because this is kind of the interesting part of the story. Where did the raw information come from for these questions and responses?
Yeah. So what I wrote about specifically was that a whole bunch of big companies like Apple, Anthropic, Meta, Nvidia, Salesforce, and a whole bunch of others are actually training their large language models on the subtitles of almost 140,000 movies and TV shows. Of course, they're also trained on millions of other things, but this is like high quality copyrighted work that, based on what I know about how large language models work, is pretty important. This really high quality professionally written stuff is very important to building high quality large language models. And of course, they did this without telling the writers of these shows that they were doing it. There's certainly no compensation involved, even though this is, you know, a derivative work is usually something that a screenwriter would be compensated for.
Yeah. So one of the things you mentioned before we started was that if you take an LLM and you start training it on its own material, for lack of a better word, that you get kind of a weird response, right?
Yeah. So if you train a large language model on its own generated output, it actually stops working. It's called model collapse. That's what the AI developers call it, which is kind of a technical demonstration of the lack of value in AI's output. It's very nearly content-free, I think. It tends to consist mostly of just the sorts of things we say around the core of what we're actually trying to communicate.
When you say it stops work, I'm just curious what that actually looks like. I mean, does it just start spitting out gibberish, like sentences that don't make sense, words that aren't words? Like, what does the actual collapse look like?
Yeah, it's gibberish. It starts misspelling words. It's pretty funny. It's almost like a cartoon of a machine malfunctioning is kind of what it looks like. It conjugates verbs incorrectly. It just does all kinds of messy things. And again, it's because its actual output has so little meaning or actual stuff, you know, actual communication in it.
Yeah. And again, let's just take it back even one step further. Where did the actual text come from that they got? You describe in the piece, how they accumulated these dialogue logs. Like, where did they come from? How did they wind up on the internet to be scraped?
Right. So there's a website called opensubtitles.org, which even a lot of screenwriters that I've talked to aren't aware of this, but it's basically a community website where people kind of create subtitles for movies and shows that they like, and then they just upload them to this site. And it's just a site for sharing subtitles for movies and TV shows. They've got over 10 million subtitles on the site in, I believe, over 100 different languages. And the AI developers basically just downloaded almost 500,000 subtitle files from the site, or actually the maintainers of the site just gave them to the AI developers to use. So this is something that, you know, there's maybe some benefit from this site. I think that's also questionable. It's very it's a site that supports movie pirating as well.
I wanted to ask about that because it does. It feels like, all right, there's a site that has accumulated all of these subtitles. I'm sure there is some sort of fair use argument for doing that. But what it is escapes me.
Yeah, I think that's a tough one. There's a similar site that was shut down, I believe, in 2015. Don't quote me on that. It was somewhere around there, called Undertexter. It was based in somewhere in Europe, and it was a very similar site. Also, just people sharing subtitles, and that got shut down for copyright infringement. I did look into this as I researched the piece, and it was really not that clear to me why Open Subtitles, which is such a similar site, has been able to continue hosting this copyrighted material for its own profit for as long as it has. I was not able to get a really good answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Because I'm a film critic by trade. That's what I spend most of my time actually writing and working on. And when I am writing a piece and I need to go back and find a line of dialogue, right? There are movie transcript websites that are really useful in that regard, that either help me figure out what the exact line of dialogue was, or it reminds me where in the movie it happens. And that way I can like throw in the disc or, you know, turn it on Netflix or whatever and go to that part of the movie and rewatch it. So I understand from a research point of view why something like this could be helpful, but at the same time, having that sort of just massive, that kind of just huge mass of captions and subtitles. I don't understand. I just don't understand what people would do with it.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the site, it is very specifically aimed at helping people watch movies that they've downloaded illegally from places like the Pirate Bay and, you know, other BitTorrent mm-hmm. sites. There are so many subtitles, partly because for any given movie, there could be dozens of different subtitle files. They all have the same text, but they have different timings for each line of dialogue for different releases of the movie. So, you know, there's like several different DVD releases. They're streaming from different services. And the files are all named in ways that help you match the subtitles to pirated releases of these movies and shows.
So basically what we have here is a collection of pirated captions on a website for pirated movies that these companies have kind of vacuumed up to create new. How would you describe what a large language model creates? What's the phrase you would use?
Hey, that's a good question. I think I would just call it plausible verbiage.
Plausible verbiage.
Yeah. It's not writing, you know, it's a very different, mm-hmm. it's not doing anything remotely like what a human writer does.
Yeah. Plausible verbiage. I like that. All right. So this gets us to like the central copyright question, right? Which is, if these programs are being used to create new commercial works, does that fall afoul of how we understand copyright to work?
That is a complicated question, which is being worked out in over 20 different lawsuits as mm-hmm. we speak. The argument is a little bit different depending on what kind of AI you're talking about. So there's some visual artists that have some lawsuits against AI companies. There's a lot of writers that have lawsuits. There's some music publishing companies, record labels. The status of all these cases is a little bit different, and the arguments for fair use is slightly different in each one. But for screenwriters, you know, I think what am I trying to say here? Nobody knows, really. Mm-hmm. The tech companies say it's fair use because we're not copying the text. Mm-hmm. You know, what these machines are outputting is totally different. It's inspired by the text, but that's not really true. Sometimes they do emit quotes, mm-hmm. direct quotes from the source, from their training data.
Yeah, you describe this as the memorization problem in your piece and in a previous piece.
Yeah, I've written a separate piece about this for The Atlantic as well. I think it's a major problem that will become, it's the core of the New York Times lawsuit against OpenAI. The New York Times was able to actually get ChatGPT to emit, you know, 90% of New York Times articles verbatim. Mm-hmm. Now, the Times had to prompt ChatGPT in very specific ways to get it to do that. We don't really know how much ChatGPT is plagiarizing or copying like large chunks of its of text from copyrighted sources in normal usage, but it's not safe to say that it never does it. It probably does it, you know, sometimes. We just don't mm-hmm. know how often. So the fair use argument is really not very strong, despite what some people say. You know, but it's not clear that the plaintiffs in these cases have a slam dunk case either. This is totally uncharted territory. Copyright law is pretty old. You know, the fundamental object of copyright law is the copy, which is referring to a physical copy, ever since the digital age began, you know, 30 years ago or whatever. Copyright law has become very complicated, and AI just complicates it even further. So I think we really don't know legally what the status of this stuff is, and we're probably not going to know anything definite for a while.
And so what's interesting is that it's not, you know, one of the things you highlight in your pieces is that it's writers who are bringing these lawsuits. It's artists who are bringing these lawsuits. It's not the studios or the publishers. Why is that? You know, why aren't the big companies that are being ripped off, you know, trying to stop this?
Yeah, I was surprised when I published a piece last year in The Atlantic about books being used to train artificial intelligence. I specifically put in the piece tables showing how many books from each publisher had been used. So it was over 30,000 books from Penguin Random House, 20,000 from Simon & Schuster, whatever the numbers were. And I expected that within a few months we'd have lawsuits from these publishers because their books had been taken. That did not turn out to be the case. And I believe the reason is that these publishers are planning to use the technology to generate new books that they can sell. And the same thing with these subtitles. I doubt that we'll see any Hollywood studios suing over the use of these subtitles. I suspect that they're trying to figure out how to use them, how to use the technology that's based on the subtitles. In order to pay less people, make movies more cheaply, make more money, whatever it is. I don't have, hard evidence there except for the lack of lawsuits.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think it's Lionsgate has allowed their material to be to be used by some of these large language models. It's with movies, it's different too, right? Because a movie is a project that is owned by a corporation. It's directed by, a specific person. And yes, there is a specific screenwriter credit. Yes, it stars all these people, but it's still essentially owned by Paramount or Warner Brothers or whoever. With the book publishers, it's a little different though, because the book publishers, right? Like a book publisher can't, I would assume, without your permission, do whatever they want with your book that you have written. You know, they can't just say we're gonna republish it like this and screw you if you don't like it. Like that's not how it works, right?
They've been doing that actually. There's one thing that's been happening very quietly is a number of licensing deals that publishers have of magazines and books have been cutting with these AI companies. And I forget which publisher it was off the top of my head. But definitely, they cut a deal. They made a huge part of their catalog available for AI training and just said, writers, you can't opt out of this, nor are you being compensated.
That's wild because it's one thing to put it in future contracts, right? To say, like, if you publish a book with us, it will. But they did it for things that had already been published?
Yes.
Oh, wild. That's kind of surprising. Yeah, I mean, let me steel man the argument here, right? The argument is if I Sonny Bunch sat down and was like, I'm gonna write a screenplay. How do I write a screenplay? Well, I'm gonna watch a bunch of movies, and after I watch a bunch of movies, I'm gonna I'll buy some. Screenplay books, either, how to write a screenplay book, or I will buy like actual screenplays and I'll read them. And then once I have my idea, I will sit down and I will write the screenplay in the format that is prescribed by the industry. And I will use the tricks that I have picked up to do it. And we, the large language model creators, are just doing that at a larger scale. If you can check out a book from the library and read it and use that as inspiration in your own writing, that's no different than what we are doing, right? That's the basic argument.
That is the basic argument. And it seems like a decent argument because these large language models are so good at imitating formats, as you say. Like if you give ChatGPT a format and say, write something like this with, bold here, and this is should be in speaker's name should be uppercase, it can do that. But there's a big difference between a large language model and a human, which is a human is alive. It's surprising to me that this doesn't get talked about more. It's a pretty obvious fact about us. We have a range of emotions. We can feel joy, pain, sadness. We can also die. And I think that our need to navigate life, or the fact that we do that in a body, a physical body that has a range of emotions, that is the actual source of our creativity and intelligence. ChatGPT doesn't do anything remotely like that. It just produces plausible verbiage. It just kind of imitates the surface characteristics of the way we communicate. I think that generating movies and books using AI almost literally just takes the life out of movies and books. I think that is something that as a culture we're going to have to reckon with in some way. We don't seem to have the vocabulary for it at the moment, which is, I find, again, very strange and very interesting, that you're sort of in this whole conversation about how similar computers and humans are. The most obvious fact about us, we are alive and they are not, somehow doesn't really get talked about. I think it's crucial.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because look, this is a question of metaphysics, and the law does not have a good way of grappling with metaphysics, built into it. That's a real, pickle.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's, that's why I think, these machines are never going, they don't make movies or write essays that are actually good. They don't have a sense of what's good. That's what we have from our kind of embodied experience as human beings. They can, again, only mimic kind of what they've seen.
Yeah. Let's bring it back slightly to the to the legal question of the rights of the copyright holders, right? So if I've written a screenplay and I find that it's in your database that's on the Atlantic, I'll link to it too. So all the screenwriters out there who are listeners can check to see which of their stuff has been pilfered. But you go there, you find it, you're like, oh, I wrote this episode of Seinfeld, I wrote this episode of The Simpsons, and it is in this program. What does the actual remedy look like? Because look, there's a straightforward financial consideration to take into mind. Obviously, you can sue a company perhaps for relief in that form, but the data itself is probably out there forever, right? Like this is a sort of you can't really unring that bell situation.
Yeah, unfortunately, any model that was trained with these scripts has been trained with the scripts, and you can't undo that. These models cost tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars just to train. And there is actually no way to undo the training or partially undo the training. And getting a company to throw out something that costs them tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars is something that a judge is maybe not that likely to do. Although we'll see. As far as remedies go, I don't know. It's a tough situation. There are a whole bunch of class action lawsuits. Most of these lawsuits against the tech companies are class action, and so it's possible that some writers will, eventually get something from that if the plaintiffs win. But I don't as far as what to do. I think learning about how the technology works, understanding what it can and can't do, and kind of resisting companies or employers or people that are using it kind of blindly without, as if it's just a kind of oracle or an actual source of intelligence that isn't dependent on the work of people, try to just avoid using it thoughtlessly like that. But it's a really tough question right now. The tech companies have been so aggressive in what they're doing. As you say, it's very difficult at this point to unring the bell.
Yeah, I want to get back to that question about how it should be used just in one second. But to I guess follow up on the remedy question. I mean, is this a circumstance where you will end up, OpenAI or Microsoft or whoever, you know, the companies that actually own and have programmed these things, pay almost a sort of royalty fee, like they just have to, and they end up cutting a check to the Writers Guild for, $20 million a year or something. Like, what does, I am trying to think of solutions to this problem that help writers in a way that, make up for some of the either lost revenue or, frankly, just creates a new revenue stream for them. Because I guess here's my point is that, if you write a thing and it's published and you paid your residuals and you get, your fee for writing it, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know, I'm not sure what the damage specifically is to have that thing then uploaded into a large language model, right? Like if you pirate a DVD, you theoretically deprive somebody of the residual that they would get for that DVD. But if you do this, it's just like it's a wholly different thing.
Yes, and that's why these copyright lawsuits are so complicated. What exactly are the AI companies taking when they take these scripts is the question at the core of these lawsuits. And again, it's so hard to answer that right now. But I would say that without the work of writers, they would have nothing. A large language model without really good training data can't do anything at all. The tech companies love to say, we're training on everything, basically, everything that's ever been written. And so you shouldn't complain because you're just one, minuscule part of this. But that just doesn't really work. First of all, they're not actually training on everything. What they're training on is pretty carefully selected. They know that they need high quality text if they want to have a high quality product. And so they are select. They do actually depend on the work of writers and specific writers, which they are choosing. But it is, you're right. It's like, they're not making a copy of those writers' work. What are they doing? They're making some kind of derivative work, but it's not really derivative in the way that a human would make a derivative work, and that you read something and you're kind of inspired by it. It's, there's no actual intelligence in these systems. The whole of what they can do comes from scripts and books mm-hmm. and other writing that's out there. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I can't give you a more definitive answer there, but it's a really complicated question.
Well, I mean, it's just, like you say, it's such untrod ground that it's hard to figure out even the right questions to ask for something like this. Because, you cannot, or at least my understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, you cannot copyright a work that is wholly made by AI program. Is that's correct? Am I understanding that?
That's correct. Of course, what the Copyright Office is now trying to deal with is how do you, how much human involvement in the creative process is necessary before you can copyright it, which again, that's such a complicated question. I'm not sure how they're going to deal with that.
Yeah.
But yes, you're correct. If 100% machine authorship is not authorship, according to the Copyright Office.
Possibly a dumb question here then. Does the amount of, quote unquote, machine authorship depend on how labor intensive the prompt is? If I'm making a AI image and I go through 37 different iterations of the thing before I get what I want, does that count as human labor? Is that an original creation?
Yeah. So there's a lawsuit that I believe was filed within the last few months that is basically arguing, it's filed by a guy who I believe made over 400 refinements to his original prompt. And the lawsuit is basically saying, look, that's a lot of work. 400 different prompts is a lot of work. I deserve copyright.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. I don't think that prompting a computer to make something is remotely comparable to actually doing the work of making a making something creative. Yeah, it might help you think about what goes into a piece of creative work, but you're not actually taking the steps and doing it yourself. You're not using your own intelligence and creativity. So I have a feeling that that lawsuit is not going to win, but who knows? You know, the Copyright Office denied that application, just saying it doesn't matter how many times you refine your prompt, you're still not doing the work. Mm-hmm. So, again, who knows how that lawsuit is going to go? But that's where things stand right now.
Yeah, no, I just it's so interesting. There was something you mentioned you mentioned before, and I want to follow up on that now, which is the idea of educating users what this sort of thing is good for, what it can do, what it should be doing, and what it should not be doing. I mean, if you just were coming up with broad guidelines on how companies, how individuals should be using something like a ChatGPT or whatever, Grok, you know, whatever program that they're using, what would your guidelines be?
I think where this stuff bothers me the least is in really formulaic documents. So, like, you're writing a resume, I think it can be helpful for writing a resume. The training data that's relevant there is just people's resumes. It's not creative work that people would otherwise be compensated for, or that's really all that meaningful. I think that's an interesting and probably legitimate use of the technology. Something like a business email maybe falls into a similar category. I think just the certain kinds of writing require more creativity than others. And I think the more creative you're getting, the more dicey it is to use this technology. I mean, first of all, they're not going to do a very good job, so it's not clear why you'd want to use them. But I think ethically, it's also just really fraught, again, because you're making something that is based, perhaps unfairly, on work that people would not have shared if they knew it was going to be used in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. And it also, there's also a question of what people expect when they ask you for a product or a project, right? Like, if you are commissioned to write a brief in a lawsuit or, you know, something else, and you wind up using the majority of if you generate the first draft or whatever through a prompt, are you earning your $500 an hour or whatever the actual, you know, fee is? Should there just be more disclosure on this sort of thing? Should people be required to say, yes, part of this was done with, you know, a AI LLM?
I think there should be. I don't know if that's going to happen. I mean, it would be, you know, there's a reason that tech companies are being so secretive about this. Mm-hmm. Is because it's really ethically dubious. And they have a huge amount of money invested in keeping it as secret as possible. I don't think, you know, they will kind of publicly talk about disclosing AI created images because they, mm-hmm, sort of can't avoid that subject. Everyone is so afraid of deep fakes. That's a place where the tech companies can say, okay, we need to label all AI generated content. But outside of photographs, and videos, you know, realistic videos, I don't know how much it is in their interest to have things labeled. It's definitely not in their interest to have people understand the training data, you know, and that's why I'm doing the work I'm doing of exposing the training data, because I don't think we can really have a conversation about the technology without knowing what it's trained on, you know, have a conversation or understand when it's okay to use it.
Yeah. No, it's I mean, it really is. And again, the thing I find kind of most interesting here on a secondary level is just the extent to which fair use is being kind of claimed as the basis for the legality of using these things, which is again, it's one of these things where if you steel man the argument, it sounds plausible, but it really does feel different just doing it on a mechanical, mass-produced level in that sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing to keep in mind is, like, this technology is not really for us. You know, you can use it to make a resume, you can use it to help with emails, but the biggest companies in the world are investing billions of dollars into this technology. They're not building it so that we can write resumes more easily. They're building it so that huge corporate customers can save money by hiring fewer humans, mm-hmm. right? And we're already starting to see AI-generated advertisements everywhere. I would assume that advertising companies are already paying, hiring fewer human artists and writers. I think a lot of this discussion is a little bit moot. You know, is it like a human or is it not? Like, the fact is, this is an automation technology. It's like any other automation technology to come around in the last few hundred years. It's the main purpose is to pay fewer humans to do the work. And I think all these functions that it does are kind of like, helping us write emails and things like that and generating images and answering questions. This is sort of, it's a PR effort. It helps us feel good about the technology that is, I think in a few years, we're going to realize how bad it's actually been for us.
Yeah. There was a funny little flare up in my corner of social media. I don't know if you saw this, but there's a new high res release of I Love Lucy out, and they use some sort of AI upscaling technology to, you know, kind of sharpen the image, and it had this very weird effect of some background faces essentially had faces superimposed on them, like they had like really ghastly ghost images in the background. And it's just the sort of thing where, like, we know how to make old film look good, and especially something like I Love Lucy, which was shot on film and has been preserved very well. Like, that's actually not hard to do. And whatever we're doing now to save, you know, probably several hundred thousand dollars on, you know, the people it would require to go frame by frame and make sure that this sort of thing wasn't happening is not worth it.
Yeah, I like that almost as a metaphor for what's happening, these ghostly faces in the background, right? The appearance of human beings without actual human beings.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. Is there anything else you think folks should know about the use of, you know, not only screenplays, you also covered the novels that have been uploaded to these large language model education programs, whatever we want to call them, the large language model vacuum that has sucked them up. What should folks know that we didn't discuss here today or that they should keep in mind?
I think we covered everything pretty well. I would say, just to end on a slightly more positive note, I think, this is not a great situation, but it is an opportunity to just think about, what it is that we do, like what our intelligence and creativity is, and to nurture the things that help us do better creative work. We have a innate sense when a movie or a book is good. It resonates with us in a certain way. It makes us feel certain things. Again, AI just has no capacity for that. And so I think it's just worth, thinking about why we do feel certain things and trying to live in ways that, nurture that. Be careful. Be careful about using machines that claim to be able to do those things as well.
Yeah. Alex, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonny. It's been fun.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.